George?
John, hi.
How you doing?
Buenos dias.
Yeah, same to you.
Doing okay. I'm a little, just ever so slightly jet-lagged and groggy.
Oh, well,
I got back late last night from the lovely village of Olean, New York.
Oh, you did that gig out in western New York.
The Olean gig, yes.
At St. Bonaventure and...
In the Olean Library and their speakers program. And,
right.
And you did that a few years ago, right?
Yes, I did. And it was a very peculiar and, but overall, very a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. They told me that they were telling stories about past speakers, and one of them was Gregory Corso, the beat poet.
I was going to ask.
stories, too.
Yeah, how he said in the middle of his talk or at some point in the library that what he'd always wanted to do was have sex with, although he put it in...
cruder terms.
Yes, with a librarian. And
yeah.
there was this sort of shy, classic, sort of shy female librarian at the back of the room.
Yeah, like Audrey Hepburn with glasses working in the bookstore.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess he chased her out of the auditorium. And
I forget if they actually consummated the relationship.
Yeah, the version I heard was that she later came back in and they asked him, you know, after he followed her out or whatever it was, and she said, no, I turned him down.
Yeah, sure.
And then I guess the next day, there was a woman who was volunteering to drive him back to Buffalo, New York, which is where the airport is, and she wouldn't let him drink vodka in the car. Or drink anything, you know, alcoholic. But he insisted on drinking, so she'd keep pulling over, and he'd have to get out of the car and, you know, take a slug of the bottle and get back in.
Those beat poets.
Yeah, the remnants of the beat. I met Corso once when I worked in Minneapolis for the Minneapolis Star, and I was writing a profile of him because he was there to give a talk.
Uh-huh.
And I remember he seemed, you know, I just met him, and it was at the Walker Art Center, I think it was, and met him in an office there, and it happened to be my birthday, so I first thing I said was, hi, it's my birthday, and he really liked that. And he seemed like a jolly guy. I remember there was huge snow outside, and I learned a word from him that I had never seen or heard before. It's Acthonous.
Acthonous. Yeah, and what does that mean?
Now I better look it up. It was a title of one of his, I think, his recent book of poems. Autothonous.
I remember something, the one line I can remember from his poetry, and I hope it's from one of his poems, is something like, Tyrannosaurus Rex with red taillights.
Wow.
Oh. That phrase always
stuck in my
mind.
From the Coney Island of the mind.
Yeah.
Little Ferlinghetti.
Back then, it was almost like you were required to be a raging alcoholic and, you know, piss in fireplaces at fancy parties. Actually, that was Jackson Pollock, I think.
Exactly.
But, you know, there was this certain persona that you were supposed to have if you were a poet. You'd be right on the edge of, and sometimes off the edge of, mental illness.
Yeah.
And, yeah, some really entertaining characters, although
I used to really, really kind of admire and look up to them when I was in college and would, you know, read Ginsberg and Kerouac, and not, now I kind of, in retrospect, they seem kind of annoying.
Well, in our profession, I guess the equivalent would be Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, yeah, he was kind of doing that same thing.
Yeah, heroic amounts of alcohol and every kind of drug known to humanity, and sort of cultivated insanity. But it's, you know, he ended up this kind of unhappy person, so...
Thompson did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he blew his brains out, so I guess...
Well,
I guess he must have been.
Yeah,
that's
he certainly went out in glory, I guess.
Yeah. So, all right, I've got to explain something that you're not privy to at this point because you can't see me. So I am I'm actually dressed in some equipment that belongs to my son. I'm wearing a an Army issue floppy hat, and I'm wearing something called a, I think it's a shemagh, which is a shawl that is worn by freedom fighters in Iraq, and now some soldiers. And I'm wearing a cami camouflage shirt, and then a vest. There's some name for this. I'm not going to try to say it because my son will be even more embarrassed than he already will be seeing me talk about these things because I always screw it up.
Yes, yeah, like we saw your father on Logging Heads TV, and he looked really weird.
Yeah, and he called a BDO CBO, or I see a BDO. I think it's battle. Oh, see, I already screwed it up. it's a name for basically a uniform, but they call it a BDO.
So basically, you and your son were wearing terrorist uniforms and playing with guns a weekend or so ago. Is that what I recall?
Yeah. So my 15-year-old son Mac, he got into paintball. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and then graduated to something. So paintball, you shoot these little balls of paint at each other, and you know what, you're supposed to be killed when you can see the paint splatter on your body.
Yeah, sometimes I see the paint splatters when I go out hiking in some areas around Los Alamos, interestingly.
Well, now you're probably going to start seeing these little white BBs. Actually, they come in different colors, but they're usually white. But they can also, you know, they can be black, all sorts of colors. But Mac graduated to this BB game called Airsoft. They're sort of plastic BBs, not the old copper
type. Airsoft?
Airsoft. You know, so he's been into this for the past 2 or 3 years. And he says that paintball is sort of for families and dads and moms and kids, whereas airsoft is much more realistic, and it's for people who are really into military reenactments. And Mac has gotten into it in a very serious way. So this vest I'm wearing is very similar to a vest that would be worn by soldiers in Iraq. It's got all these pockets for magazines for holding your ammo, spare clips. They communicate by means of radios. I'm holding up a radio here.
Yeah.
You have to wear goggles so you don't get shot in the face. So Mac's got these goggles that are actually wire mesh, so they don't cloud up, and this protects you from the BBs. He's got it's called a camelback. This is also worn by troops in Iraq, which is a water bottle that hangs on your back, and it's got a tube coming around the front. So you've seen bikers with these, too.
Yeah.
But it comes in really handy. You know, if you want to... So I'm holding up Max's gun now. If you want to drink water at the same time as you're, you know, shooting bad guys. And this gun... The guns are incredibly sophisticated. They can be powered either by CO2 or propane or...
Yeah, propane.
Yeah, or propane.
I remember those little CO2 cartridges...
Well, apparently...
Like, I used to use those in model rocketry.
Yeah, you can... So Mac is... I think this is non-standard, but you can use the sort of Coleman stove-type propane tanks to power your guns.
Oh, propane. Okay, so...
But Mac's gun here, which I'm holding up, is an electric gun. So it's actually got a motor right here, a battery-powered motor that propels the BBs at a very high velocity. It's about 300 to 400 feet per second.
Wow, that could put your eye out.
That could definitely put your eye out. And he's got a really sophisticated scope here, a sniper scope. These come with laser spotters on them.
Wow.
And, so I participated in this war game over the weekend with about 60, 65 other guys, and we were supposed to do a reenactment of the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia.
Also that's why you're wearing the Somali gear.
Yeah, although some of the American soldiers wear this too. Yeah, so I was what they call them terrorists. I called myself a Somali freedom fighter. And
yeah, it's all in the semantics.
Right. And it was, I got to tell you, George, it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah?
I mean, sort of sneaking, trying to sneak up on people and shoot them without them seeing you. I mean,
yeah.
That's what I was hoping I could do. What it turned out that...
this was right up your alley.
I was killed actually about 10 times because I had on this... I wasn't dressed the way I am now. This is Max stuff.
Yeah.
I had on a green down vest, which I thought would sort of camouflage me.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it made me, by far, Mac told me later, the most visible person on my home team.
No wonder you were killed 10 times.
Yeah.
But you were resurrected. And
yeah, they have these elaborate
the great
rules.
Great Mecca
for
in the sky and all
right.
The virgins. And
yeah, that's the nice thing about it. You get hit and you just go, ah, shit.
Yeah.
And you kind of walk back to this place and then you come out fresh.
Good that it were
fighting.
Really that way.
But,
well, yeah, I could see how this might, you know, might be fun.
Well, so here's the question.
And it's good practice for the coming depression.
Yes. So, first of all, this is definitely good, you know, sort of survival skills for the end of civilization, which is obviously approaching very quickly, and I've got to get over my peacenik, bleeding heart, liberal shtick, and
that was a luxury for wealthier times.
Embrace this new set of values. So at some point, I guess I'll get a real gun instead of this BB gun. But the larger question, these types of activity that it raises, is whether or not these kinds of war games provide a healthy, benign outlet for male aggression.
Ah, okay.
So Conrad
then,
Lorenz, you know,
so
the Nobel...
I'm going to step away from the camera to turn off the fan that I left on back here, but might garble your account here. Okay.
Conrad Lorenz, in his famous book on aggression,
mm-hmm.
which I'm holding up here, I think it came out in the late 50s, early 60s, 1963, he talks about how hardwired aggression is in all animals, particularly in humans, though, and in humans it's particularly lethal, of course. And he says at the end of his book that, you know, we can't just evolve away from this instinct. The best we can do is to find outlets for it other than war or homicide, assault,
yeah.
interpersonal violence. And
yeah,
he suggests
or investing in complex financial instruments.
Yeah. Now, he actually doesn't mention that, but of course...
Wall Street warriors.
You see a lot of aggression on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, it's really probably comes from those same primitive instincts.
But so what do you think about so it's basically the catharsis theory.
Yeah,
actually,
I guess it all ties into this, you know, violence on television thing where, you know, we're spectator catharsis, whether that reduces violence or encourages it. And I guess I think it encourages it.
You do?
Yeah, so, because it really, it just gets your mind into these, it sort of expands what's considered possible by your brain, and if you're playing violent video games all the time or watching violent programs in which people are shot and it seems, you know, really exciting and cool and a lot of fun, I think there's at least a certain type of individual that's susceptible to that and comes to glorify it, and then they live in these movies that they're running in their own little heads, and they think that they're, you know, they're playing out these great dramas because their lives are otherwise so boring and miserable. I mean, I think that's kind of a lot of the motivation for gang members.
Gang? So I was going to ask you, so this is, so actual, so the people who like these sorts of movies or video games or TV shows, you think are more inclined to actually be violent in real life.
Yeah, I guess I think that. But I think it's only one factor. I think a lot of it probably depends on your intelligence quotient or your whatever measure of intelligence you want to use. A very smart person, I think, can probably do these things ironically. and at a certain distance, and maybe then it's cathartic or at least harmless. But I think for certain people who are either poorly educated or just not very smart, you know, they really have trouble maybe not distinguishing the fantasy from the reality, but they can kind of turn their whole lives into these fantasies where they're fighting these wars, and they actually talk, you know, like characters on TV and use the same language because they've become so absorbed into this little world.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. I've been thinking about this, obviously, since I participated in this, since I've become part of this world, and you know, I've spent two successive weekends now up at this place in Massachusetts with all these other guys. The first week I just took Mac there, and he and a friend did the war game, and I just hung out with some other dads.
Yeah.
And the last week I decided to participate, but now I'm getting to know some of these guys. Actually, one of the guys who runs it is, I would guess, about 350 pounds, 53-year-old guy named Jolly. Everybody calls him Jolly. I think his last name is Jelinski or something. And he wears camouflage. He doesn't actually go out and fight. He's sort of the referee.
Yeah.
And he sets the rules, and he hangs out in this place where you're supposed to go after you're killed, and he times it and then sends you back. But he had a white Jeep with a bumper sticker on it that's one of the best bumper stickers I've ever seen.
Oh, what was it?
It said, "Waterboard Barack Obama."
Oh! God.
I told him that
surpasses what I thought was the most hilariously right-wing, imbecilic bumper sticker that I saw, which was, "Vince Foster would still be alive if he'd had a gun."
that's great, because that takes a second.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, my favorite liberal bumper sticker is, "When campers are outlawed, only outlaws will have campers."
That's good.
Yeah. So this guy is probably a George McCain, Sarah Palin supporter.
Absolutely.
Palin probably especially.
Actually, you're right. So he said that Palin...
She probably plays these games with Todd and Trigger or Tigger
Real
or
bullets.
Whatever.
Here's the thing. Most of the... or certainly a good proportion of the guys at this thing, and they ranged in age from about 14 to... You know, I was by far the oldest. I'd say 14, mostly up to about 40, and after that, most of the older guys just were hanging around, because it's actually pretty arduous. You're running around the woods with, you know, in the case of my son,
maybe 50
pounds.
Well, yeah, you're supposed to get the young guys to do this, you know. So, socioeconomically, how were the other dads? Were they?
I'd say it was pretty blue collar.
Intellectuals and academics and.
No, but here's the thing. As far as the catharsis theory goes. Many of these guys were military. So the leader of my Somali group was, I would guess, about 30 years old, and he'd already done three tours of duty in Afghanistan and Iraq. He was in Afghanistan with the first invasion back in 2002. Mm-hmm. So, how do you explain that? These are people who've been in real war, and actually the leader of the American side was a sergeant who was in Army Special Forces.
So they're not doing it, you know, ironically, I imagine, and they're probably not doing it because they need some kind of catharsis, but because they actually enjoy probably the strategy and the...
Right.
I mean, obviously it takes, you know, a lot of very quick thinking, you know, and being in the moment, and there's probably this certain Zen-like experience when you blast your opponent with the plastic BB.
Yes, absolutely. There is a lot of strategy. That's why you use the radios for communication, and the American side in particular, they broke people up into reconnaissance groups, snipers. They'd always have a point group that went out to try to make contact with the enemy to find out where they were. And they all communicated by radio so that they could coordinate their defenses and attacks on us.
Wow.
So if you just look at the United States, the catharsis theory doesn't work at all. There's a very high correlation of between our fondness for extremely competitive and pseudo-violent games and actual violence. I mean,
yeah.
The United States is extremely violent compared to other industrialized nations, and it's very warlike, obviously.
Hmm.
But here's the interesting thing. This game started in Japan more than 30 years ago, Airsoft did,
huh.
And it's extremely popular in Japan still today.
Oh, so maybe it's working there.
And so if you just looked at Japan, the catharsis theory would look much more plausible. I mean, it's still just a reverse correlation, and establishing causation
yeah.
might be difficult because Japan is basically, it has had pacifism forced upon it.
Right.
You're not allowed to own guns there, and of course they, you know, scarcely have any armed services at all. But, and so this is a way for Japanese men to indulge their fantasies.
Yeah. Hmm.
So I think this just shows, you know, it's typical of social science. You can, you know, you can prove virtually any principle depending on the society or group that you you examine.
Yeah, and there's just, you know, again, there's just so many variables. I mean, it serves different purposes for different people, I imagine. But it does seem to tap into this, I'm going to use the word in a sentence, it taps into this autochthonic sort of impulse for, you know, violence and competition and aggression.
Nice.
Autochthonous.
I wouldn't use autochthonic.
Autochthonic. It's so, yeah, you should look it up because it's, you, the first time you look at the word, there's this huge, giant glob of vowel, not vowels, a huge, giant glob of consonants in the middle. A U T O C H T H O N, yeah. Autochthonic. Yeah, the Gregory Corso word.
Yeah, I have seen that word, but I never knew what it meant. Just
yeah, so it means kind of primal or indigenous or, you know, of the earth. Or, yeah, and it also has geological, you know, sediment or rock, so it's kind of like, you know, earthy.
Yeah. Well, I'm always looking for ways to enhance others' perception of my erudition, so that would be a good word to add to my book.
It is, and if you need to cite Corso, the book is Herald of the Autochthonic Spirit.
And I
remember asking him what autochthonic meant, but I couldn't even say it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So anyway, you engaged in an autochthonic weekend with your son.
I did, and it was fun, I have to admit. And
I should
probably
do something like that.
I'll probably be doing more of it. You know, I need an escapist fantasy at this point because everything I feel is crashing down around me. So.
Well, yeah, it's also training for when you have to defend your vegetable garden.
Yes.
Yeah, against wild, crazed zombies from Wall Street. So I was going to ask you, you know, the last time we talked was 2 weeks ago, I think.
Yes.
And we were talking about, you know, the sort of perverse exhilaration that one feels amid the dread or beneath the dread or somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Over, you know, the idea of impending disaster. And I was looking back just out of curiosity, and on the day we talked, the Dow opened, looks like, at about 11,300. You know, because everyone was just really depressed because it was so low.
Those halcyon days.
And then it plunged all the way down to 10,400 and something. You know, and now that just seems like, you know, that we were talking about the great calamity, the economic calamity, the downfall of our economic bubble that our whole system's based on, and now you look back and boy, don't you wish the Dow were that high?
Yeah,
it's
well,
so
like I said, you know, with Thomas Homer Dixon, you know, that Canadian political scientist, it's time to forget about going into cash and to stockpile gasoline and water and guns and ammo.
Yeah, yeah. It's down another 350 points now as we speak.
Oh, God, are you kidding?
No.
Oh, Jesus.
82.30 and 1.30.
Don't tell me that. I'm hanging in. I'm just not going to pay attention. I'm trying to avoid.
No, I'm doing the same thing because, you know.
You don't want to sell now.
Don't want to sell at the bottom. Of course, now we wish we'd sold at the bottom when the, you know, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It seemed like the bottom. But.
Yeah,
it's kind of scary, but. There's still, I guess I wouldn't say I feel quite as exhilarated as I did before, but when I was driving around back from Olean, New York to the Buffalo Airport yesterday, they had satellite radio in the rental car, which I'd never experienced before, and I was listening to some all talk, all finance, all stock market, all the time kind of hysterical cable TV show, and I can't remember what it was called, but they had their correspondents from all over the world, and they were getting on, and they were talking excitedly about, for example, Iceland going bankrupt, and it was just, you know, getting bailed out possibly by Russia, and just, you know, just all the excitement, and you could tell they were, you know, kind of high on it, sort of like war correspondents, that adrenaline rush.
Yeah, except that a lot of these people are probably going to be out of jobs soon. The media was already teetering on the edge of collapse, over the last several years. And this could really be the last straw for lots of big newspapers and magazines.
Well, yeah, for anything that's really fluff.
Yeah.
And if satellite radio is not fluff, I don't know what is.
Right. And Blogging Heads TV, I think, is going to emerge as a go-to place for wisdom in this time of calamity and anxiety.
Well, it has the advantage of a low overhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can ride this out because
and we'll be
no
unemployed,
bank loans here.
So we'll have even more time to work for free. You know, to keep from, you know, while we're out tending our vegetables in the back and, you know, getting out the radiation counters and
vegetables. Time to start building a still. I think we're all going to need to get drunk through this.
Still would be good.
This coming apocalypse.
Yeah, but again, I guess what we were talking about before was there's still this feeling that gee, maybe some good will come of this. You know, getting back to basics.
You know, I just sent an email to Bob this morning. So the headlines have recently been. The need for Europe, for countries in Europe to coordinate more, and for Europe to coordinate with the United States, and even for all the nations of the world with significant financial resources, China and India and Russia, Japan, to coordinate their efforts to try to overcome this. And it seems to me that this could be a prelude to one worldism, to the recognition.
One world government at last.
Yes.
Yeah, just like H.G. Wells wanted.
Right.
So this would be the equivalent of, I think we've used this analogy before, but the robots in the day the Earth stood still coming to Earth and finally getting it through the heads of the Earthlings that you countries have to cooperate or you'll be blown up by robots from outer space because you're too dangerous for the solar system.
I really think
so. The economic crisis will have this role.
It just shows it's such a powerful demonstration of the interconnectedness of all the global economies and of the foolishness of the idea in the United States that we can sort of go our own path and pursue our own interests regardless of how it affects others.
Yeah.
So that's my one little sliver of optimism.
Yeah. Just hard to be optimistic about, even under these circumstances, getting any kind of meaningful cooperation. But maybe, at least at the best, I think it's going to lock in a very, very low bottom.
Yeah. I think also another upside is I can't imagine any scenario in which McCain and and Palin win this election. I mean, Obama looks calm and measured. He's smart.
Yeah.
I mean, he's people will look to him as somebody who maybe won't save us, but gives us a better chance, certainly, than the crabby old white man.
But it also, fear brings out people's kind of right-wing xenophobic tendencies, and Sarah Palin plays right into that.
Yeah. It's our good side and bad side at war again, George.
There they
go. Which will win?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, too, the whole global economic thing. I mean, everything that we were, and people have been talking about this all week in various commentaries, but everything we were told to do by the experts has turned out to be wrong.
Remember, didn't we have a chat over the summer about, I cited a bunch of statistics from a book. I should have looked it up before this talk. I didn't know we'd go here. A book by a social scientist of some kind on he had done a 20-year study of the predictions of experts in politics and economics, and found that they were basically about as good as chance.
Yeah.
And, the record was horrible.
Yeah.
And here we have a really dramatic demonstration of the ignorance, really, of even the most learned people.
I mean, it's a complex system that's beyond comprehension of the human mind, and we pretend. Well, when we were talking about the Black Swan guy in the last conversation, and just even what seemed like common sense wisdom, when you would be advised, your Merrill Lynch or your Charles Schwab newsletter, it's important to diversify.
Right.
You want to have not only domestic stocks, but foreign stocks. Because if one goes down, then the other will go up. Well, no. All it means is all of your funds are going down, whether they're foreign, domestic, and no matter how spread out, over what industry, everything is basically...
Well, and of course, then there's the... when it comes to the advice you get from people in the financial industry, it's affected by, what's it called, the vendor bias, or there's a term for, the simplest explanation, or the simplest example of it is the advice that you get from your car mechanic.
Yeah.
So your car mechanic says, darn it, looks like you need a new transmission. And the problem is that he has a very strong financial motive for giving you certain kinds of diagnoses.
Oh, yeah, right, and your stockbroker makes money whenever you sell a stock.
Right.
Buy a stock or sell a stock or move from this fund to that fund.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, the invest for the long term.
Right.
That's what I've always believed, but, really, what bullshit.
Right.
I mean, the best thing in retrospect would have been to, if you thought a stock was going somewhere, to buy it, keep a close eye on it, and if you got up like 20% or something where you were doing better than you could do far better in a bank account, sell it.
Yeah.
Cash the profit, and if you were, if it was going down, the hell with it, cut it loose. So until about 2 weeks ago, I believed I was doing the right thing by going for the long term. Like, I hung on to my Apple stock that I bought.
I still got Apple and Amazon.
With the splits, I bought Apple at the equivalent of just a few bucks a share in the early 90s. And then it had gone up more than 100, about 100 times what I paid for it.
Wow.
Between 75 and 100 times.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then now it's dropped to half its value.
Yeah.
But, come to think of it, it's still worth a hell of a lot more than I paid for it.
Well, see, there you go, George.
Yeah.
There's always an upside.
Yeah, I've got to...
Somewhere.
Yeah, I've got to bite the bullet here. The long term is right. I've got to go for the long term and just hope that the long term doesn't last longer than I do.
Hey, so...
So what are we doing talking about the economy here? We're not economics people. We're science people.
Yeah, but we know as much or as little as any other schmuck out there. That's the whole point.
You saw that article in the Times about Greenspan?
I saw it. I didn't read it.
Yeah, it's one of the great series called The Reckoning. They're doing it about how we got into this mess. It's just wonderful reporting. But anyway, it starts with an epigraph, which is a quote from Alan Greenspan in 2004. It says, quote, "Not only have individual financial institutions become less vulnerable to shocks from underlying risk factors, but also the financial system as a whole has become more resilient." And the reason was because of derivatives.
Well, there's another expert for you.
And he's still defending that. He's saying that people just misuse the derivatives.
Yeah, or they just, you could always just say it's all panic.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, George Soros years ago called derivatives financial time bombs, I think. No, I guess that was Felix Rohatyn called them potential hydrogen bombs. And then, Buffett and Soros, and they all had these very, they basically said this is just way too risky. But Greenspan really believed in them. And, combining that with, loosening up the money to get over the 9/11 crash of the economy, and then fueling the housing market. It's just, I'm learning a lot.
Now all of us have to. We're all forced to learn more about economics than we want.
Just amid all this, it was hard to pay attention to the fact that we're in the middle of the Nobel Prizes. This wonderful thing where people are rewarded handsomely for purely intellectual endeavors, and sometimes intellectual endeavors that have important benefits to humankind, and not people that are just rewarded for playing with all of our money so they can, buy country houses in Maine. So let's celebrate the Nobel Prizes.
Okay, but there's going to be a downside coming up, George.
Well, first let's talk about a really good one.
Okay.
I know what you're getting
physics?
At.
Physics?
I like the physics one.
Yeah.
It was given for basically discovering something called broken symmetry or hidden symmetry. It was just so great. I was listening to an NPR Morning Edition report driving on my way to the airport to go to New York this week, and I was just listening to them. The press release had just come out, and they were kind of trying to say what this was about, and it hadn't been turned over to their really good science reporters yet. But broken symmetry, it's just such an interesting idea, and the metaphor that I always think of is like if you pick up a quartz crystal or a piece of galena or pyrite, fool's gold, and there's just, it's very geometric,
mm-hmm.
and you can see it's made of little cubes or little tetrahedrons or something, and yet the symmetry is flawed. It's just kind of coming out at weird angles, and there'll be something that looks like this perfect geometric cube, and then you look closer and you see there's all these little flaws in it and this broken edge, and this always seemed to me like kind of a nice macroscopic manifestation of the idea of broken symmetry. So that basically, deep down, the universe is symmetrical and mathematical, but in kind of coming to fruition, this harmony becomes sort of flawed, and you have to work to recover it from the effects of randomness.
Yeah, I guess one of the great storylines in physics over the last, 50, 60 years, is that reality is thought to have begun in a perfectly symmetrical state with a single force.
Single particle, it was one.
Yeah, and then somehow, this kind of multifaceted, perfect jewel that you can spin in all directions, and it doesn't change. It's still essentially the same. And then somehow it goes through these different phase changes, or just shatters. But then it continues to shatter in different ways.
The universe cools and it shatters into these different the four different forces.
Yeah,
and they're all weird and different.
Actually, this is a very Gnostic idea. It's sort of Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah, also has this idea of reality originally being this sort of perfectly symmetrical divine force that then is somehow, something goes wrong and it's shattered somehow.
Yeah, the demiurge screws things up.
And
it's the fall from the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
You know, it's just all tied in with that mindset where it was perfect, beautiful, mathematical, symmetrical, and then as the things cool down, these different forces split off, and they're weirdly different. So you have light, which is carried by photons, which have no rest mass, and so these massless particles that since they're massless particles, as a result, that's the highest possible speed of signaling. And then you have something like the weak nuclear force that causes nuclear decay, or the engine of nuclear decay, and then that's mediated by these really fat versions of the electron that have all this mass, the W and the Z bosons, I think they call them.
Oh,
so
God,
it's like this broken symmetry, and if you could go back and rewind the clock, there would just be these wonderful, pure, beautiful photons, and then you have the gluons for the strong force, just that same idea that if you look deep enough, you can find the hidden harmony. But
and also there's the idea, so now we've got string theory, which appeals to the existence of these hypothetical higher dimensions. And the way that I understand, string theory is so obscure, but the way I've tried to understand the significance of these higher dimensions is that, if you think of us living on Earth, we're basically living in a two-dimensional world, and we don't see the symmetry of the Earth. But then when we rise into space, we can see that the Earth is this sphere, which is a perfectly symmetrical object. So you rotate the sphere, and it basically doesn't change. And as I understand it, by creating these higher dimensions, it's sort of the same effect. You rise into these higher dimensions, and you see these symmetries appear in the particles that exist in our three-dimensional world here that you can't see just in this three-dimensional world.
Yeah, so you rise high up enough through the dimensions, and then all of these different forces end up looking like different facets of the same jewel.
It's a wonderful idea. It's so Platonic and sort of spiritual that it makes me suspicious. I feel like George Johnson when I look at symmetry breaking, because you're always sort of implying that some of these patterns are being imposed on reality instead of actually being intrinsic to reality. And our infatuation with symmetry does make me suspicious, especially as it's being embodied now in string theory and some of these higher dimensional theories.
Yeah. No, it's just fascinating. It's just such a basic question.
Yeah.
And it was just so wonderful to think that you could get a prize. I mean, they didn't do anything involving experiment. It was all just theory.
I've been hearing about this guy Nambu for a while. He was he was the mentor of a
so he was one of the winners. There were three winners, and he was the American-born, Japanese-American winner.
Yeah, he's at the University of Chicago.
Japanese.
Yeah. And he apparently did his theoretical work 40, 50 years ago, a long time ago.
Yeah, and he I talked to him when I was writing my biography of Murray Gell-Mann, Strange Beauty, and there was a lot of back and forth between them in the era when they were coming up with the idea of the color force, and the gluons and basically, putting together some of the structures for the standard model of physics, which describes all the particles. And yeah, Nambu was very important in that.
Well,
the idea of color charge.
I wonder why it took him so long to win.
I don't know. It does seem like it's possible that they were kind of grasping for someone to...
Right.
I mean, hidden symmetry is such an old part of physics, and that was really hidden. I mean, it was hidden, embedded in the whole standard model of particle physics, which a lot of people have already gotten Nobel Prizes for their different pieces.
Yeah.
Like Glashow and Weinberg for uniting electromagnetism and the weak force, and then David Gross and who was it, Gross, Politzer, and Wilczek for coming up, you know, with, you know, I guess more with the strong force and putting it all together in the standard model. I kind of forget who did which piece, but yeah, quite a bit after the fact then to, you know, give the prize to people who came up with this very basic concept on which it all rests of hidden or broken symmetries.
Better late than never. So I'm just going to mention my Scientific American colleague. It was Manishree Mukherjee. I don't know if you ever met her.
I remember the name. Yeah, she was one of the senior editors at Scientific American.
She had a PhD in physics from University of Chicago, and very, very smart. And she would talk about Nambu as this kind of Yoda-like figure, a really wise, very deep thinker. So I'm sure she's thrilled that he finally got the credit that he deserves.
Yeah.
Well, so how about, what about the other Nobel Prizes, George?
Oh, okay. Well, the only other one that really, I guess it struck everyone for the same reason was the one in, what do they call it, physiology or medicine?
Yeah.
And having to do with, half of it or part of it was awarded for discovering basically HIV, right? That was the cause of AIDS.
Yes.
And the fact that it didn't go, and it went to Luc Montagnier, French scientist, and not to Robert Gallo.
Right, and a colleague of his, François Barré-Sinoussi. Probably mispronouncing that.
Yeah, but, someone I really knew.
So I was, I joined Scientific American in 1986, and one of the first articles I did was on AIDS research and what they were discovering, what they weren't discovering, the effort to create better tests and so forth, and treatments. And Robert Gallo was the go-to guy for reporters, particularly at Scientific American then.
Yeah.
So I talked to him a bunch of times doing different stories, and he was really a powerful personality. Spoke really rapid fire, this sort of barrage of information and ideas, and he was very opinionated about other scientists and would be very candid about the deficiencies, supposedly, of other scientists. So he was actually a great source for reporters. He was a real quote machine. But then there was this whole controversy over whether he had discovered the AIDS virus first or Montagnier had.
Yeah.
And the two of them had this this battle back and forth and a lot of name calling, actually, especially on the part of Gallo. Montagnier is a very gracious man who's just not a street fighter, and Gallo really was a street
fighter.
Pretty
scrappy guy.
And so then the question was, you know, who was right or wrong? And
to back up a little, I remember the issue had to do with whether what Gallo had discovered in his laboratory was basically a contamination from HIV that had been isolated by the French laboratory, and that they had borrowed some of it, and it somehow had gotten mixed up with their own cultures, or
right.
What is that? Is that right?
Well, so what happened?
Details.
The reason I made up this is such a complex story that I never could figure out who was right or wrong, and then
there's a whole book about it, right?
Yeah. So then a few years ago, I think it was 2002. There was a book written by a guy named John Crutzen, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who had actually done a whole series of articles for the paper back in the, I think, the early 90s, accusing Gallo basically of having stolen credit for discovering the AIDS virus. And then
he really got, you know, right way into the biochemical, molecular, biological nitty-gritty, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it was just amazing.
Totally
amazing
immersed
journalism
in this story. And then he, but there were these investigations of Gallo that all sort of ended up inconclusively. And so then Crutzen comes back in, as I said, I think 2002, but I'll link to it on the Blogging Head site, with this huge book, over 600 pages, just detailing the whole chronology in this really minute detail. And I reviewed this for the New York Times, so I was sort of forced to come to some conclusion about this. And I thought that Crutzen's book was, there was too much detail. And yeah. He sort of was rubbing your face in all his legwork, when instead I think he needed to pull back a little more and give you a broader picture to try to determine whether, just how culpable Gallo was. Yeah. But I thought buried in there, there was very persuasive evidence that Gallo had, basically the story was that Gallo had announced he had discovered the AIDS virus as early as 1982, I think. And but it turned out that this virus wasn't in a lot of AIDS patients. It was a very old, well-known virus. And then, meanwhile, Montagnier later announces that he has discovered this different virus that's associated with AIDS. And so Gallo starts denigrating, but he says, "Why don't you send it to me? I'll take a look."
Oh.
And so then Gallo says, "It's not it. This isn't it. The French virus is, some other virus." But Gallo later announces that he has found a new virus that's a variant of the first one that he had announced, and this is the real AIDS virus. Mm. And then other people started looking at it, and they said, "Wait a minute, this is the same as the French virus." Because by this time, they could do these genetic analyses and determine the AIDS virus would mutate so rapidly that if you had genetically identical viruses, that meant that they probably even came from the same patient.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Gallo finally admitted, okay, this is the same as the French virus, but then he somehow implied that the French had stolen it from him.
Oh.
I mean, it really got very convoluted, but I thought that overall the book really made the case that that Gallo, maybe partly through incompetence and partly through this insane competitiveness, he took credit for something that wasn't his. And then there was a later scandal and competition over the blood test. So Montagnier developed a blood test that was more effective than one that was developed by Gallo, but Gallo used the weight of the federal government to exclude Montagnier's test from the United States, and there was money at stake, of course. And Gallo's test wasn't as good as Montagnier's, so according to Crutzen, there are people who actually died and were infected by the AIDS virus because they got blood transfusions from blood that had been screened by the flawed U.S. test and hadn't, and the AIDS virus had gotten through the test undetected.
Yeah.
So really, it was, the book comes down on Gallo and says that he was really bad for science, he was bad for medicine, and it's just a case of scientific competition being incredibly destructive. So I think it's a great thing that Gallo was excluded from this Nobel Prize.
Yeah, and it was a real surprise, too, because, in the past, haven't the scientific community, or that part of the scientific community, kind of, whatever they were saying privately, they kind of closed ranks and just sort of agreed to say, well, let's give them both credit. Was it the Lasker Prize? If it was the Lasker Prize, when they shared this, it was sort of taken as the community saying, well, let's let bygones be bygones. These things are hard to sort out, and these are both great contributors. So, and the Lasker's sort of considered, like training wheels for getting a Nobel.
Right.
But then he was excluded. He was very gracious, though, when he was interviewed by the Times, wasn't he?
Well, I think he realizes that his ship has sailed on this, and or sailed a long time ago. Scientific American actually negotiated with Gallo and Montagnier to write an article in which they both shared credit with each other for discovering the virus. So it was a history of the discovery of the virus.
Wow.
And this was almost like a negotiated treaty between the two of them, negotiated by Jonathan Peale, who was the editor of SIAM, mm-hmm. and really liked Robert Gallo in 1988. And then they had another article in Science a few years later that also created this kind of cleaned up history and sort of swept the name calling and the accusations under the rug. I think that was mainly Montagnier just decided life is too short. Yeah. You know, let's just move on, and I'm happy to share credit with Gallo if he insists on having it. There was even an international negotiated agreement between the U.S. and France, with Ronald mm-hmm. Reagan on one side and whoever the president of France was, and I think this was 1988, on the other side, to share royalties from the two tests.
Yeah, I sort of remember that.
But the Nobel Foundation, to its credit, tried to look at what really happened instead of going along with these sort of antiseptic versions of scientific history.
Yeah, it would have been the easiest thing in the world just to, you know, say, what the hell?
Yeah.
You know, and give it to them both jointly. So instead, they... And the prize was split between basically that and another discovery, right, with the papilloma virus.
Which is, you know, that is definitely... The papillomavirus discovery is interesting, and there's some...
Yeah, I mean, you kind of think it's, you know, something as big as discovering HIV, you know, would warrant a prize, a solo prize.
Well, maybe they figured if there was going to be a third person, they would have to give it to Gallo.
Yeah.
And so they decided to give it to this other... I mean, I would love
that
to have been
sense.
A fly on the wall.
Because they would have to, yeah. So, but by including this other... human papilloma in with the prize, they basically, since they can only pick three people.
Right, so this is a guy named Harold Zurhausen who discovered the link between human papilloma virus and cervical cancer. What's interesting about this, I was actually thinking of talking about this in an earlier Blogging Heads, is that there is now quite a bit of controversy over the vaccine for the papilloma virus, which has become extremely popular over the last year, which supposedly protects women from getting cervical cancer.
Right.
So, I mean, this vaccine has been controversial from the start because the religious right has opposed it because they think it will encourage promiscuity by young women. And it's given to girls as early as... 12, 13 years old, and say you're supposed to get it before you become sexually active. It's been really vigorously promoted by Merck, and GlaxoSmithKline. And it turns out, I'm looking at an article by Elizabeth Rosenthal in the New York Times that came out in August, that there really is very little evidence that these vaccines are effective. Mm. And so there's been a tremendous amount of money being spent. These vaccines are expensive.
Yeah,
if
you can find something and create a target audience that includes every female, every adolescent, prepubescent female in the world, that's huge money.
Yeah. So there's, you know, what makes this a difficult issue for me to form an opinion on is that it's the two different sides are both groups that I loathe.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got the religious right on one side.
The pharmaceutical industry and the religious right.
Yeah, big pharma against the fundamentalists.
Yeah.
You know? So they're both, you want to believe that they're both wrong, but...
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible, but, I mean, you know, you don't have to be a fundamentalist Christian, or you can even be an atheist or an agnostic like myself, and still, I think... wonder whether, you know, what kind of signal you're sending if you tell your 12-year-old daughter that you're going to start taking this pill because, you know, we assume that in the next few years you're going to start being sexually active and probably sexually promiscuous and you might get this virus and we want to protect you from that. So it's like, I mean, there's no way you can do that without sending the signal that says, you know, that we assume you're going to do this and this is really okay, but just, you know, let's make sure you don't get infected. I mean, that's the same question that comes up with, you know, contraception and how freely that should be made available. And,
yeah,
and of course, the rational answer is that, well, you know, let's not, you know, kid ourselves. You know, people are going to be sexually active if they are so moved that way, and that, you know, we should face reality and protect them.
Yeah, I guess.
It does send a signal.
I don't really have a problem with the, I don't have a problem with the moral issue, because I do think it's exactly analogous to telling your daughter to use contraceptives, and
yeah.
I just think that that's common sense. The question is, and something that we've talked about before, do you when do you decide that a medical treatment or test is worth the money and time that you're investing in it? And in this case,
yeah,
I guess
yeah.
the payoff is fairly small. It says here that they, according to one analysis by a group at Harvard, giving this vaccine to 12-year-olds would cost $43,000 for every quality-adjusted year of life by preventing a cancer death. That
oh,
would be
I see.
Considered acceptable in wealthy countries. But, you know, this money could be, that amount of money could be used in other ways. I mean, this
yeah.
to some extent is a zero-sum game. And so it's a question of how we should use our medical resources. And you know, the larger issue for me is that you just can't trust big, medicine is so corrupted by drug money
yeah.
that you just can't trust anything that they say.
Yeah.
It's really a shame.
Yeah, you need some kind of independent tribunal to decide these things.
Yeah, so maybe we need to nationalize.
We need to nationalize
the medical industry,
we need to regulate.
Yes.
But you know,
market,
this thing about the,
is it gonna do it?
You know, I'm just kind of puzzling over what, I'm not sure what I believe about this, but, you know, whether the, you know, what kind of signal, you know, it sends to, you know, say, you know, here's this vaccine because we assume this is what you're going to do. And it seems like the issue is tied in with what we were talking about earlier as far as, you know, whether violent TV shows and movies and video games or maybe playing war games like this contribute to violence or not. And still, I just have this suspicion, I guess, that anything like this, you know, we create the culture in which we live, and by making decisions like this, you're actually changing the reality, you know, in which people think and live, and sort of opening up these new spaces of possibility. And if
yeah.
you see that somebody solves one of their problems by, you know, sneaking up on them in a dark alley and shooting them through the head and maybe get away with it, you know, this opens up this space. And for most people, they would be, you know, they would immediately close the space up and then, you know, retreat back to something less deadly. But, you know, it's the same thing about sexual activity. I mean,
well,
another question is sexual activity, you know, among teenagers bad per se, and you know, you can argue
that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But just the sense that I think we don't take seriously so much as a culture how much decisions like these, which are usually left to the marketplace, actually open new realities and change the way we live. I'm not saying it very well because it's something I've been kind of struggling with for years.
Well, let me just say, I think the
able to articulate.
I think there's a, and I'm sure you would agree, there's a significant difference between violence and sexuality. So I want my children at some point to have great, healthy sex lives.
Yeah,
I do not ever want my son to be shooting people in real life, whether it's in war or you know, he's joined a gang or a violent militia. So you know, that's the problem I have with you know. So it's always struck me as a real paradox that parents are much more worried about their kids watching movies with explicit sex scenes in them than they
violence.
Are with extremely explicit violence.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
So, you know, I think that some, you know, hardcore pornography is degrading and it's awful, and it would put bad ideas in the heads of young people.
It is tied with violence.
And it can be tied with violence. So there is a connection there. But on the whole, as I said, you know, sex is, hey, we need it for the perpetuation of the race, and it's part of a healthy, joyful life. And so, whereas violence, I don't know. I'm a free...
So sex
free speech
is
libertarian. Pardon me?
Sex is autochthonous, but you're not sure that violence is.
Well, it might. I think violence.
I hope
violence
they call this the autochthonic edition, by the way.
That's a good one. Yeah, because then I'll be forced to know how to spell the word.
No.
I see it on the top of our.
That'd be a real spelling bee stumper.
But I think violence very well could be autochthonic. But we're going to grow past that. We're going to evolve into a species that finds other ways to fulfill our fantasies, resolve our disputes, exorcise our demons, whatever.
Well, I admire your optimism.
And it will be when there's a one-world government that is practicing an enlightened governance of all people and has taken over all the banks and the corrupt drug companies, and everything will be wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's still going to take the robots from outer space to enforce that, but I'm going to try to be more optimistic this weekend after this cheery talk with you.
I'm going to go out and shoot some stuff.
Yeah. Oh, hey, the Dow's down 466 now.
It's time to go and practice
getting
my gun again.
Close to that 8,000 floor.
Alright, stop.
John, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, same here, man.
Yeah,
hang in there.
Be careful out there on the war front. And
yeah, don't sell.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Okay,
right,
I'll hang in there if you do.
Okay, we'll do.
Okay, John,
over
see you
and
soon.
Out.